Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is a Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is episode 163, and we're going to talk about Silence, which is a Martin Scorsese movie from 2016, so just last year. So Martin Scorsese's made a few movies.
Yeah, and I'm just not, his style is not for me, generally.
Mm-hmm. Are there any of his that jump out to you that you're like, oh, I do like that one?
I know. I'm sorry I didn't expect that question, but I really...
And I didn't expect to ask it.
Yeah, I...
Just popped in there. Because, I can give you my answer. And, okay. And my answer is no. I don't have a movie that I've seen of his that I just absolutely loved. Looking through the list and everything, he is a director that I just haven't really connected with, in any kind of meaningful way, I would say.
No, I really why that is, I don't like him.
Okay. Yeah. All right then. So why did I pick this movie despite that? That's the question right here. So I watched the movie because, a lot of people were talking about it, and I just waited for it to come out on DVD. In fact, I waited. It was long after. In fact, I saw it probably, what do you think it was, 3 months ago maybe? Because mm-hmm. I talked to you immediately, because that's what I do.
I pulled the tile out from under your foot just in time.
That's right. So what I did, I watched it, and I was a little bit perplexed by it. And then I looked at some reviews and I talked to you about it. And then something kind of happened. It was like the movie was a vehicle. It opened a door for me mm-hmm. that I didn't realize had been closed. And the reason that this movie is personally important to me is simply because of what it made me consider. Not that I believe in the message that he was presenting. And as a matter of fact, I believe that anyone can watch this movie and come away with whatever message they feel like, because it's so ambiguous and it doesn't really take a stand. But for what it opened for me and what it made me think about that I hadn't really thought about deeply before, for that reason, I really like this movie.
And what was that?
It was the concept of apostasy and martyrdom.
Ah.
So the martyrdom is something that, we hear about, we read about. But this is the first time in which I think I really felt it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started to consider it, especially after I talked to you the first time. Because it was like, well... we'll get into this, but, from the time that I spoke to you the first time to now, there's been a lot of thought that has occurred, a lot of discussion that has happened, a lot of reading that's happened. Mm-hmm. So it's one thing to sit there and think about, well, St. Peter was crucified upside down. You have all these other martyrs that did various things. They died for the church. They died and they would not deny it. It's one thing to read about that, but then to somehow consider it deeply and what it means is a whole different thing. And we've talked about similar things before where somehow some piece of art makes you feel something personally that you knew already, but right. you never really felt it.
Mm-hmm.
That was it for me. I knew it intellectually. I knew that these martyrs had died, but then when you think about how they died and what they died for and the details of this specific moment, not the violence, but the I'm not going to let this go.
Right.
Right. That moment is something that now has sunk in much more deeply than it ever had.
Wow. Well, in that case, that was really good because it started that whole contemplation for you.
Exactly. Exactly. But the negative part about the movie is I feel that a person, the way that it was presented, I think a person could come away from this with a very incorrect answer.
Well, and in fact, in preparation for this, I listened to Real World Theology because I had read the book at least a decade ago for my book club. And I don't recall the book being quite as, it's ambiguous about a lot of things, but I think it's also less sentimental in some ways in the way it presents the main character's conflict. He has all these conflicts. It's a fairly faithful to the story, but Scorsese did add some things that are kind of his own commentary and interpretation that kind of firmed some things up at the end, which I really was like, oh my gosh. So we'll talk about those. But what this book did for me was I had to stop and think about the choice the priest makes at the end. I had to really decide for myself what was the right choice. And I remember it wasn't super obvious instantly. So it also made me stop. Now, I didn't think about it for too long because I just kind of was sorting it out and going, nope, no, no, no. So when you came to me saying, what about this issue? I already had a chance to think about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if I seemed unnecessarily decisive at the time, I was I was just ahead of you in that curve. Mm. But we all three in our household, we did not approve of the message the movie conveyed by the end. And in fact, my husband said, I'm not sure why this movie was made. Hmm. What was even the point?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's like, yeah, I get it's about doubt, but, you know, so what? The way the movie shows it to you, which is kind of what you're saying about the ambiguity of some of the stuff. Now, to get back to what I started off saying, so I was listening to Real World Theology thinking, well, maybe they'll have some insights that just didn't occur to us in our continual conversation over this movie. And one of the people there said that he felt, spoiler, but he basically felt that the priest's decision was the correct one. It was a moment of grace, that the priest in his decision was embracing Christ more fully than he ever had. And I was like, what are you talking about? And he kept coming back to that again and again. And the other two people on the podcast didn't necessarily agree with him, but they didn't ever really fully argue out the question. And I was listening to it going, see, here's the problem with this kind of a new agey, wishy-washy conclusion that I feel the movie had. These are the debates that have been going on in print about it ever since it appeared.
Okay, that's interesting. So the problem that I have with how the ending was presented is that, like this other person, you can take away anything you want out of it. It sort of reinforces whatever it is you're feeling personally or whatever you think personally already. You can find evidence for that, in my opinion.
Right. Especially if you enjoy a lot of crying along the way.
Right.
Sorry, it just had to be said.
Yeah, and the thing is, you know, sometimes ambiguity is a really good thing. And maybe the ambiguity in here is what's sparking all the conversation. And I do appreciate the conversation. You know, it's not unlike the Da Vinci Code, right? When the Da Vinci Code came out and everybody was like, oh, but that's, you know, what are you guys doing? You know, why are you attacking the church and all that stuff? Well, you know what it did is it generated a lot of conversation.
Right.
And I think that was good overall.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people looked at a lot of things that they wouldn't have looked at before. So same with this movie. But when we read something like Turn of the Screw and it has kind of an ambiguous, you know, you're like, that kind of ambiguity is really interesting to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
But here, it's almost as if I'm not going to take, and this may be coming from the book, I don't know, but there's no stand taken. It's like it presents to you the question and it says, was this the right choice or not? And then you talk about that. And maybe that was the intent. Maybe the intent was, I'm not going to make a stand.
Well, I think also it's interesting, too, because the book was written by a Roman Catholic Japanese man who, as 1% of the population when he was growing up, who was Christian, was rejected a lot by everybody, right?
Mm-hmm.
And but he said in Japan, the view of Christ was always as the triumphant Christ, the reigning Christ, the resurrected Christ. He went to Europe to study and found the suffering Christ. He'd never encountered that aspect of Christ before. Although I'm like, did you not read a Bible? I mean, I don't understand his background very well, clearly. Not being Japanese and going Bible. Suffering Christ everywhere. But anyway, so that really kind of changed his thinking. And he was hoping in Europe, oh, I'm going to be one of the majority, except there he was Japanese and it was after World War II. So people weren't loving him in France, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You're still one of the enemy. So the whole time he's writing, he's struggling with these questions and he's struggling with Japan, as he's famously said, being like a swamp, he finally concludes. You know, the bright fire of Christ can come into it, but the wetness of the swamp kind of puts it out, and you kind of have to change Christianity for it to work in Japan, which is an argument that I reject. So he's bringing all that to his book, and it's been so long since I read it, but I did look over a few kind of in-depth summaries as I was trying to see where the movie's different than the book. Because Scorsese leaves one thing more ambiguous than the book does and makes one thing very clear that the book left ambiguous. So then what you have on top of that is a movie where he's been trying to get this made for, what, 20 years or something like that? So you have, as I read somebody saying, kind of his reflection upon the book after 20 years.
Yeah, I did see an interview of Martin Scorsese, and he said he read the book in 1989.
Okay.
And then he said he didn't fully understand it at the time, but knew that he wanted to make it. So I didn't get the impression that he was trying to get it made all that time. It was like, someday I'm going to make this. And it sort of bubbled in his head. And then eventually it looks like he wrote the screenplay, him and another person. So,
well, yeah. And I had just heard this various places. I had seen them saying it was a long time, not from the time he read it. For a long time, he'd been trying to get funding. And we could see why, because I think it cost $40 million and he made $14 million.
Oh, you're kidding. Wow.
I think it was something like that. Yeah, I mean.
Nice.
I know, I kind of feel like, so only people like us who are really interested, we're going to see it. I mean, it's a 2.5 hour long movie about priests and torture in ancient Japan. So enjoy.
Did the movie do well? I mean, it sure seemed to be talked about by a lot of people.
It was critically acclaimed, I think, by most people.
Yeah, I was just wondering, did it make its money back and all that?
What I'm saying. He spent $40 million.
Uh-huh.
He brought in $14 million.
Oh, I thought you said, I totally misunderstood. I thought you were telling me that he made personally $14 million out of the $40 million budget.
No, no,
$14
no.
was his.
That's
what I thought you said.
No, I'm sorry. No. Let's see here. But
my misunderstanding. Yeah.
There was, and I would be interested to watch this other film since I just happen to be looking this thing up now. Did you have a chance to watch the 1971 film?
No, I did not.
That Masahiro Shinoda made.
No. Did you see it?
Mm-mm.
Okay. No, I didn't. I didn't take the time to do that.
No, I wonder, you had mentioned you thought you might try.
Yeah, I was going to do that, but then actually I totally forgot about it till you just mentioned it.
I'd be curious to see if it was any different. Let me just double check. So, yep. Oh, now it says $16 million.
Okay. So it hasn't made much money at all.
No, it's made like almost nothing.
Yeah, and it is, you know, it is a very, very slow movie. Should we synopsize it really quick?
Yeah.
Because by far the most interesting thing about the movie is what it brings up, so that's why we're leaping into that.
It's also beautiful and well acted.
It is, yeah, and it is. It is very well shot. It looks fantastic, and it's 2 hours and 41 minutes long. And it is not a fast paced movie in any stretch of the imagination.
No.
So what it's about when it starts, we're looking at two Jesuit priests in Portugal who are reading a letter that was written by Liam Neeson.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember.
Brother Ferrara.
That's it, Ferrara, right. And he was a another Jesuit who went to Japan, and he was describing some things that were going on there. And these two Jesuits were getting ready to go over to Japan, but the, I don't know if you call it their superior.
Their superior, I think. Yeah, the superior general, sometimes they're right. called.
So he's talking to them, and because of what's in the letter, he's thinking, it's probably not a good idea for you guys to go over there.
Yeah, they cracked down on everything.
Yeah, and they had heard, I can't remember the source of where they heard this, but that Father Ferreira had apostatized and, denied the faith and was living as a Japanese person. But the letter that they were reading didn't say any of that. The letter was from Ferrara, I believe. And so Andrew Garfield's character was arguing that, the person who wrote this has a strong faith and where this is just hearsay. So yeah, absolutely, we should go over there.
Also, we're his students. Groupie. We can't believe he would have denied the faith. We're going to prove it wrong.
Right.
Essentially, you get that feeling.
Anyway. Exactly. And then they eventually talk the Father Superior into letting them go. And then through the magic of cinema, they're suddenly there. And they, in what I found just beautiful was their interaction with the native Japanese people and the hidden Christians, right. And the masses and all the stuff that was going on right around there. I just thought that was beautiful,
really beautiful
stuff. Yeah. So they're hidden. The Christians in Japan are persecuted. So they have to hide the fact that they're Christian. And these two priests, were hidden away in a shed, all the time. It's like they had to sit there in the shed till it was dark and they'd go outside. But then they'd say mass and things and very nice.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Baptizing babies. And because they were left with what they had was a headman, they would call him.
Mm-hmm.
And he could baptize, but he couldn't administer any of the other sacraments. And that was passed on over time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
so now the persecution becomes a real problem.
Rumors of their presence, I think, get heard, and so the Japanese send people to
send people to hunt this down, and the way that they're doing it, they arrive in this little village, and then they have a tile with the image of either Christ or the Holy Family. I can't remember everything that was on there.
I think it was Christ. Sometimes at the table, at the table with the apostles in the Last Supper, sometimes just him.
Right. And then they make them just step on the tile in an act of apostasy, saying, well, if you don't care about this stuff, then just go ahead and step on this, and then we'll believe you. Even though, they're sure. they're sure that these people are Christians, so they know that they're causing them issues. And so I'm not really sure how much more to say about that, but that starts to roll into the persecution gets more and more intense. And then eventually what we're given is Andrew Garfield's character, who is the main character of this movie. His name is Rodriguez, Father Rodriguez. And he's the one who, like you said, is a Ferrara disciple or a groupie. And, this is the person who he's emulating throughout the whole thing. And then he ends up walking in his footsteps pretty much completely throughout the entire movie in the way that he did not want to. And, he becomes the focus and the Japanese, the people, I don't know if you call them the people in charge, are basically saying, you need to apostatize. And we're now torturing all of the Christians that we can find that are around you. And if you want to save these people, you need to apostatize.
Right.
And that is the crux of the movie right there, is his decision over a probably 90 minutes worth of film, whether or not he does this or not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's struggling. He's, and he's... taken aback by the culture. He doesn't understand the culture in a lot of ways, obviously.
Yeah.
They're both very ill-prepared, which is a huge part of the problem, in my opinion. But, yeah, and so what happens is it turns into a meditation for the viewer on the nature of doubt, on the nature of guidance, on the nature of how do you express your faith in the face of opposition when it's going to hurt other people. And for the modern viewer, well, the whole thing is very modern. And for me, the movie kind of displayed the flaws in the book's thinking that I hadn't really seen as clearly.
Mm-hmm.
It was very modern. You know, it's set in ancient Japan, but it became very clear to me that, yes, oh, right, the book is a modern thinker's contemplation of this and the contemplation of someone who is really working through his own problems.
Right. And you said it was written in the 40s, in the 1940s.
I'm not. Well, that's when he went to college.
Okay.
I think so. In, let's see, 1966.
Okay. Right in the 60s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and he'd written a lot of other books, and they all kind of struggle with the same problem, as they say. Now,
and that problem is what? They struggles with the idea of apostasy or
well, doubt? The idea of doubt.
Okay.
And how can you really believe in God? And why has Christianity never really taken hold in Japan? Is it really the true faith if it hasn't taken hold there the way it could?
Yeah.
Although even in the movie, you know, the young priest says, "Well, there were 300,000 before you started torturing everybody and killing them to the authorities." And what Endo pointed at, well, see, and for me, this all kind of ties in to go off the movie just for a second. There's a book, I think, called A Song from Nagasaki, which is the story of Takashi Nagai. I'm probably butchering his name.
Mm-hmm.
And he is somebody who, after World War II, maybe, converted to Catholicism. And he started off as hardcore atheist, Japanese, science is saving us all, excuse me. And in the telling of his story, the author of that book also tells the story of the Japanese Christians and what they went through.
Hmm.
And so I look at that, and I remember reading that when Silence, the book, came out, the Japanese Christians were just all outraged. They were like, "You are portraying us as we all just stood lined up and flapped our foot on the tile and, you know, we're weak and all this kind of thing." It's like, that's not how it is.
Hmm.
And so I look at that, the journey of that guy, Takashi Nagai, and then I look at Endo in his books, and I think it becomes even more clear to me that he was working through his own problems. And those problems are like the problems we have today.
Sure.
And that's
sure.
why the movie, in one sense, felt so modern.
I'm sorry. It's important to note here that Silence is fiction, right?
Yes.
It's not a historical, it's a historical novel, but it's not based on real events or anything like that, right?
There was a historical figure, Giuseppe Chiara, evidently.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Who was active in Japan when Christianity was forbidden, and he was trying to locate a fellow priest, Ferrara, who'd apostatized.
Oh, so that's
now,
a
he
real
was
story.
Tortured. Yeah, but he was tortured, although it says there's reliable testimony that he retracted it later.
Hmm.
Chiara was also tortured and eventually became apostate as well. He was later forced to pretend to marry a Japanese woman, taking the name and samurai status of her late husband, and would live in Japan until his death. So he kind of just took a basic concept and then wrapped his own idea of thinking of all the doubts, what did he go through, and fictionalized it. So it is historical fiction.
Gotcha.
And the fiction is especially in all the priest's thoughts. But so it's fiction. You're right. And the Takashi Nagai story is not fiction. It is true. And I'm not saying that they're equivalent. I'm just saying that it gives me... It gives me this feeling where I look at it and go, I don't know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I remember liking the book a lot. And the movie, I think it's that lukewarmness, you know, mm-hmm. that you mentioned, where you can take away whatever you want.
Yeah.
The book kind of brings you to the point of thinking about it, but the movie kind of makes it okay for you no matter what.
Right. And I think that that is what he does, especially the end, you know, which we need to talk about in detail. Because I think that the director sent two clear messages there that are contradictory. But it's like I think if a person that doesn't know, well, I mean, it's open now. So if we, you know, we're going to spoilerize it or whatever.
To the max.
To the max, right. So let's talk about this scene. So at the very end, you know, after so much torture and everything, the priest finally gets to the point, you know, after even talking to Father Ferreira, who is explaining, you know, basically arguing that he ought to do this.
Mm-hmm. Justifying himself.
Justifying
yes.
himself, right. Father Ferreira finally does it, right? He finally...
Father Rodriguez.
Father mm-hmm. Rodriguez, right. He finally steps on the tile. There is a moment where he hears a voice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the voice says, go ahead and trample on me. I was brought to this earth for this reason.
Mm-hmm.
And then he steps on the tile. And then we see the image of Jesus, which we saw earlier in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And which basically cements the fact that this is Jesus talking to him.
Well, and that's then, what he thinks.
Yeah, that's what he thinks. And then, but I think that to a viewer, I think that that's what that means.
Yeah.
And then we hear the cock crow three times, and which is, you know, that was the betrayal of Jesus.
Right.
Right? So like now Peter. Now we have Jesus, it's like the filmmaker says, Jesus talked to the guy, but yet that was a betrayal, right? Which is very confusing. And I think that a person could argue either direction, that was a betrayal and that wasn't a betrayal, and they would have evidence to support that. So in my opinion, you know, after thinking about it a while, is that that was not Jesus that was talking to him. He thought it was Jesus, so it was either an inner voice himself justifying himself, or a voice from elsewhere that's not Jesus, right?
Yeah.
And then, but it was a betrayal. It was a final betrayal. And what I've learned since, and when I really thought about it, you know, is it just means that the priorities are in the wrong order. Because I can completely sympathize with what he's thinking, and I understand how difficult it is. But yet, he made the wrong decision.
Yeah, and he'd been subjected to a lot of essential mind games and pressure from every corner. I mean, you could really empathize with, he was trying to stand up for what was right, but he has the very clever Grand Inquisitor, you know, giving him example after example. He's got this translator who's continually, you know, who I loved that actor. He did that part so well. Mm-hmm. Boy, you hated him after 5 minutes, even as you kind of enjoyed his personality.
Mm-hmm.
But who's continually needling him. You have Ferreira, who not only apostatized and now has a Japanese wife and child, but he's writing documents to discount what the church believes and saying, well, but they're so behind in medicine and astronomy, so I'm finally doing some good. So implying that everything that was done before was not right. So he's being pressured from every side, and the final blow is the five people who are being tortured in front of him, who's like, oh, they already apostatized. So they're just dying because of you.
Yeah.
And at that point, what you can imagine, he's so confused, he doesn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. And his, you know, you kind of feel like if he didn't follow through with it later, he could, like Peter, be forgiven. Under the pressure of the moment, we all can do the wrong thing. And that's wonderfully shown by Kichihiro Is that his name? Mm-hmm. The guy who continually, every time he's brought up, he's like, I'm weak. I'm sorry. I'm so weak. Please forgive me. Let me confess my sin. I want to come back to God. Will he take me back? And then the very next time he's put to any pressure, he folds faster than Superman on laundry day. And just, the Christians are over here.
Yeah.
And tells the authorities everything. And then but he's continually sorry. He's continually having to be forgiven.
I found that to be a very powerful thread in that movie.
Yeah, I think for me, I loved that character. I mean, I didn't love what he was doing, but I felt like he was us.
Yeah, yeah.
We're continually, we have good intentions, and sometimes we can carry through on some of them, but we continually are having to come back, and God takes us back every time.
Yeah.
And he is the other parallel. So you have Ferrara, but then you have this guy who's we don't see much of the other priest, but we see a lot of Kichihiro. And so he is what Father Rodriguez turns into, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we notice it becomes easier and easier every time for Kichihiro to step on that thing, to spit on the cross, to do whatever.
Yeah, you're right.
Mm-hmm. And so every time you give in, it's like giving in to, I'll just have chocolate cake tonight or whatever that temptation is for you. It's just easier the next time if you don't fight it. So that's far off of Peter's betrayal. But thing is afterwards, you have to be like Kichihiro and be sorry and come back and recognize what you did was wrong. And in the movie, it seemed like he just gave in all the way. It was all or nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel that way?
I felt like he was broken, right? So after he stepped on the thing, I don't think he ever felt good about it.
Right.
So I think that he was truly sorry. It was like he was going through the motions, but he was broken to the point where he just had no fight at all. And then at the very end, when he died, he showed that he never did lose his faith. Right.
I'm
just saying that, but he didn't do anything about it. I'm just saying that it was in there.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
He had that little cross that his wife had.
Exactly. So clearly he had spoken to his wife about it. To me that meant a lot, and I think that was Scorsese that did that. I don't think that was in the book.
That wasn't the book.
Right. So, but the implication there is that his wife, in my mind, she might even have been Christian. But the thing is, he didn't do anything, right? He wasn't practicing it. Right.
Right.
So whether or not that matters or not, I guess I don't know what my point is, but I'm just saying that I don't think he ever in his heart was fully into what he was doing as a Japanese person or as a cultural Japanese person. But he had no will to practice.
Well, yeah. And I think that kind of brings the question up is, are you, and maybe this is seems harsh, but are you really a Christian if you're not living your faith? We were given three commandments by Christ, right? Love God with your heart and soul and strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. And the last thing he said in every book of the Bible is go forth and spread the good news. And even if you're doing it in your actions more than your words, which is how it's supposed to be anyway. If that's in there, how can you deny it? I realize they kind of showed him like he was sleepwalking and kind of dead and all this sort of thing, but surely that would be the struggle he'd have. And just showing that little cross hidden in his hands, so what? I mean, I realize I sound, as I say, harsh, but what good did it do him? What good did it do anyone around him? To be a martyr is to be a witness. He was no sort of witness of any sort. Now, in the book, as I recall, I didn't go get it and even look through it, but I seem to recall the place where it was less ambiguous was that Christians would sneak up to him and also to Father Ferreira after dark so he could hear their confessions and stuff like that.
Hmm.
So there was kind of the implication that he hadn't really given it up all the way. Because one of the arguments Father Ferreira made, I don't know where else I would have gotten this, but was that, you know, they don't have to see everything you do, kind of thing. We can help them by staying here more than we can help them by going back. And that, again, is wrong. Because here's the thing is, okay, first of all, that Father Superior General, whatever he was, should never have sent them. They were unprepared. And to send two, you know, priests who aren't prepared for anything out into a foreign culture like that is unfair to everyone they encounter. And so if they're not prepared for how to express their faith properly, even to themselves, because they haven't been tested enough, what kind of a witness are they going to be? And in the Japanese culture, because the other movie this made us think of was Shogun, where there's a lot of cruelty, but the story is one of comparing and contrasting, you know, the Portuguese and the Japanese cultures. So you saw a lot of cruelty there. You saw how important seppuku was. Well, you know, those Japanese people would have respected the heck out of anybody who committed seppuku. Now, a Christian's not allowed to kill himself. But essentially, Father Rodriguez did kill himself. He suffered a spiritual death, I think, by doing what he did. And therefore, you might as well give it up in the way the martyrs did. Like they say, the people, the Japanese people at the beginning asked to be martyred so they could show their faith. And so, which is a very early Christian attitude also. So if he'd even have said, nope, that's it. If you do this, you know, first of all, if he'd encouraged them and said, this is like seppuku. You are showing the nobles a peasant can be noble too. Bring it on, Christians. Instead of going, oh, no, I don't know what to do. Maybe you should trample it. Trample it. Trample it. Save yourselves. And I was going, first of all, that's not even realistic to how a Portuguese person would have thought back in the day. They would have understood martyrdom better. They might not have, they wouldn't have liked what they saw. Okay. They wouldn't have enjoyed the watching people be tortured or being tortured themselves. But they would have had a culture from Western Europe in the 1600s of seeing that kind of thing, knowing it existed, and knowing that suffering is a part of life. These two priests are dropped in as if they came from, you know, now. Wringing their hands, and why do we have to suffer like this? Why do they have to suffer?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. Instead of going, oh, their life is worse than I imagined because it's really different, a la Shogun. But, you know, they're awful. Moving on. What can I do for them? Here's why God dropped me here. And then at the end, you get the part where he kind of goes, oh, without us, Christianity in Japan is gone. Well, okay, there's pride for you. So he never had a firm grounding, and as none of us really have the firm grounding. Oh, my gosh, I hope I never face anything like that. But I was reading, I think it was Stephen Gray Danes who referenced that way back before this in the 400s, right, St. Augustine did this essay on lying. And he talks about, okay, so say you're in a situation where the authorities have your father, and they're torturing him so that you'll give your faith up. And let's just up the stakes. Your father is a heathen pagan. He's begging you to turn apostate and get him off the hook. Is that on you? No. You're not doing that. That's on the authorities.
Yeah.
And I'm like, to let them do that to him was making himself available to their mind games. And so what the movie did by presenting all this, whatever is Scorsese's gloss on it, which I think is part of the hand-wringing and crying, frankly, is to me, I just looked at it and went, oh, right, I forgot. This whole book, the original work, was this guy working out his doubts. He wasn't worried about it being authentic. He wasn't worried about really looking at this. And yes, these two priests apostatized or whatever you call it. But yeah, we all do stuff like that. Under torture, I'd probably, you know, flip. That's why they had to have a whole council about, can we let people back in the church? Because after those horrible persecutions, where all people were asked to do then was burn incense. A lot of people died, but some people went, oh, no, that's fine, and then wanted to come back. Do we take them back? Yes, we do.
Yeah.
But there was a huge debate about it. And that this movie is just kind of redoing the debate and coming down on the side of let's all burn incense. It's okay.
That's right. You know. Yeah, that's right. And there's another in scripture. There's another one. I didn't come prepared, but wasn't it in Maccabees?
Yes.
Okay. So
Second Maccabees.
Right. So and you and I had talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
But so right in there, you know, there's the mother of the sons, right? And the sons are being persecuted and killed, and she says, "Do not give up. Do not."
Seven sons.
Right. And she says, absolutely not.
Yeah. To each one, she's going, look, we don't know how we're made. We don't, but we know where we go later.
Yeah.
You stand firm for God. And in the same series of scripture is also the story of an old man. I think he might be even 80. And he's going to be put to death. All he has to do is eat a piece of pork. Mm-hmm. And all the younger people are going, come on, we need your wisdom. It's just a piece of pork. And he's like, really? You're asking me to say that everything I have said is truth for my entire life is wrong?
Mm-hmm.
No, I will not. And those books were written about a time when the Jews were being persecuted to become Hellenized Greek.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
And so they were written to kind of show these examples and give the strength. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, also, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, yeah. So we have pretty clear instruction, you know.
Well, also, let's look at Jesus himself. And I think that's part of the problem with the story. In the book, what Endo said was that the author's named it, or the publisher named it Silence. I don't know what he wanted it named, but he didn't like that. But in the book, the priest keeps picturing Christ's face. And as he pictures it throughout the book, it becomes more and more emaciated and suffering and everything. We don't really get that in the movie. Mm-hmm. But what we get is he looks at Christ, but does he really see him as a person, or does he just see a beautiful picture, even though it's got thorns on? Because Christ wouldn't have apostatized. He's the one who told the apostles, are you sure you want to come where I'm going? You know, to Peter, yeah. They're going to take you where you don't want to go. And he was crucified upside down. Almost all the apostles died horrible deaths. And the first Christians. And what about when Jesus was born? How about those babies that were killed by Herod?
Right.
Those are the first martyrs. God didn't come down and go, oh, well, they didn't do anything. Let's put a bubble over them. Because he gives everyone free will.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't control what other people do, but you can control the witness that you give to others somehow. Even if you give the wrong witness, like Kichihiro, you continually come back and try again.
Right, right.
And that's lost in this movie, because there's not really an opposing solid Christian voice to present the other side.
That's an excellent point right there. You know, I think I was getting to the same conclusion as well. What about Adam Driver?
But he's in it for so little.
Yeah, he's in it for so little, right? But he seems to have made that choice.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
his life is that. Even though he's told his friend has apostatized, he's not giving up.
Right, right.
But.
Yeah. But you're right. He's very, very little. You know, he's not in there
during
at all.
All the arguing and the mind games and the letting him hear people being tortured, there's no one to say the other side. He's kind of left on his own. And I know that's looked at as God's silence. But the other thing I was wondering is, how often do we hear God speak? He's acting like he expects to hear God. Well, my son, let me explain it to you.
Yeah.
And even in the hardest times, the test of our faith a lot of times is that we have to kind of remember, how do we keep ourselves centered?
Because
you have to look at Christ, God and man.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. You know, and there's, you know, when you think about this in a, you know, a broader sense or a less intense sense, it's still gathering my thoughts here. Mm-hmm. The thing is, you know, when you apostatize, you're putting things in the wrong order, right? You're valuing something over God.
Right.
Right. You're letting the human suffering or this is what this priest did. He allowed the human suffering to be more important than God.
Right.
Right. So, you know, when we look at things in daily life and in church and everything like that, you know, we still got to remember to put things in the right order. And I think that a lot of the problems that we're having right now, a lot of the arguments that are taking place in church has to do with things being put in the wrong order. It's like, we want to feel good, you know, mm-hmm. but feeling good is not the number one thing, but we often make it the number one thing in, you know, in what's happening today anyway. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, you're stepping over what's being commanded in order to feel good, you know, and say, well, we can get more people if we do this.
Right. You know, and is that the point?
And that's not the thing. That's not the number one thing, right? You see, you still got to just keep it all in the right order.
Right.
Yeah. It's like what Christianity is versus the Christianity that everybody wants. You know, it's not supposed to be easy.
Yeah, and that was the other thing that where I looked at it and I thought, again, I was thinking of not only the author going, have you read the gospel? And I guess I understand if all anybody's interpreting or talking about is directing your attention somewhere else. But I'm just like, how can you ignore Jesus's life? He was persecuted. He suffered the ultimate horrible torture. I mean, and he did it without recanting. Everything he did was fully given. And it's just... And he goes through the whole book, you know, kind of crying because everybody's suffering. God, why did God choose them to bear such a burden? But surely everybody knows, like you say, suffering and persecution are part of Christian life. Even us who suffer much less than people, say, in the Middle East or wherever, mm-hmm. when they're driven from their homes or killed because they're Christian, a lot of the time, even we have to muster ourselves and go forth. You know, whether it's to scorn or, you know, being ashamed because you're having to witness to people.
Yeah, and apostasy, it does not have to be this dramatic, right? There's tiny little ones, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I remember you were saying, well, if it's a tile and it doesn't mean anything to me, then it's okay to step on it.
Yeah, and that was the first thing.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah, that was a while back. So, yeah, my first reaction when I first talked to you was, especially in the very beginning where we're first starting to see the persecution firsthand in the movie. So we're in the village, right? And they're like, you know, if you step on this, we'll leave, right? Well, if you believe that they'll go ahead and leave, I'm like, well, step on the tile, you know? That was my thinking. So it was like, if I was that priest, I'm thinking, if I believed this, I'm thinking, well, I can go ahead and step on the tile and just get back to doing mass. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, so I can sit there and then I can do that and I can just do mass. And then eventually they would get me anyway. Right. Mm-hmm. Eventually it would still happen. But I'm just like, yeah, if they, you know, because to me, the tile is a tile. You know, it's not the church, it's not Jesus, it's not anything. And then what you said that sunk into me, said, well, that's what it meant to them, though. So what it was is that the meaning of the act of stepping was defined, right? And they're saying this is apostasy, and therefore it is, right? And therefore the priest doing it is doing that as an example to everybody.
Right.
Okay, and now it starts to become more and more. So that's what I was thinking when I first spoke to you. I was like, well, step on the thing. You know, if it allows me to go continue doing what I was doing, which is really what you're there to do,
right?
Then do it, you know? That was my thinking. But it's not my thinking now.
Oh, no, and I wasn't thinking that was. I was just thinking, I think that kind of goes along with the person who was, you know, saying, oh, his apostasy was really his embracing of Christ. I'm like, nope, stop it right now. But because the thing is if it's not a betrayal, then why ask them to do it?
Right. And not only that, but there was one other thing you said that spurred a lot of thought as well. And you were saying these priests are not as important as they think they are. They are not more important. It's like... their survival is not gosh, I'm not putting words in your mouth.
God doesn't need them.
God doesn't need them, right. It was like if they
spread Christianity.
Right,
yeah.
Right. It was like, you know, the Christians will continue without them.
And they did, and they had up to that point.
Right, and they did after, right? So,
right.
But that was also a good point. It was like, you know, these guys are considering themselves more important, which is something that they shouldn't be doing.
Well, and you can see how they're kind of led into it because everybody's so grateful to have the priest there.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, right. Which I can understand. They can have the sacraments. They can have the Eucharist, which is Christ. Mm. But and they're young, and he's like, and now I can feel you. And I think it's the danger also of allowing yourself to be swayed by too much emotion. Now that I think about it. Because when everything's going right in the villages, he's like, now I see what you sent me. This is wonderful. I can feel you right next to me, Lord. And then later, it's like, what? Why? Hello? Where are you? This is awful. What's going on? I hate it. But he's always waiting to get some sign. And not that we all don't enjoy a good sign. I know I do. It's wonderful, that connection. But most of our lives, we don't get those signs. And most of our lives, we have emotions, which are nice too, but we have to also balance that, you know, with knowledge and intellect and kind of like, you know, well, I don't feel like doing this thing. Well, I still have to do it.
Right. Yeah.
It's my duty.
Exactly.
And so, yeah.
I'm with you there because, yeah, sometimes it's hard. You know, well, Mother Teresa too, right? Mother Teresa went through this darkness, right? Where she's like, where are you? But yeah, so I completely agree. You know, it's like forming the correct decisions when you're sort of really feeling it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then throwing it away when you don't feel it and saying, well, now the most important thing is X. When I was feeling good, the most important thing was the other thing, you know?
Right.
So, but then that's a downward spiral.
Right. And one of the things that you started to talk about, and I think I got us off topic, is, you know, this in churches today where we can take our eye off the prize and forget that, you know, of course we want a good life. We want to help other people. We want to have a great community and all this stuff. But the prize is heaven. The prize is closeness to Christ. And all those good, happy things don't always lead in that direction. And that's a struggle we really have now. It's a really, the secular world is a lot like the Japanese are shown in this. Well, you can believe in your heart, but we don't want to hear about it. You're messing us up. And so this is one of the points that Father Barron made Bishop Barron made when he wrote a piece about silence. He's like, you know, where the movie's left is, you know, he's got that cross in his hands. But that's the response to the secular world. Well, I'll just pull back so no one has to hear it because it makes a lot of trouble for me and they don't want that because they don't want to hear that noise. And I just so happened yesterday I was reading this story in The Voices of the Saints, which is a book I really like. It has a saint for each day of the year. And I was reading about Julie Billard. If I said that right, she was during the French Revolution and she came from a noble family or rich family that gradually fell on hard times thanks to the revolution. But the whole time, no matter what, she was catechizing and teaching kids and everything. And she became mysteriously paralyzed. She was doing it from her bed in her little village. And then a schismatic priest who'd sworn loyalty to the revolution took over the church. And he tried to visit her, but she refused to admit him. So single-handedly, from her bed, she convinced the entire village to boycott him. That's the power of a strong witness. You know, what would this priest, Father Rodriguez, have done if he had had a proper example? Stood up,
right.
Said, you've got the faith of the martyrs. My gosh, I can't believe it. You're amazing, you know. And there's one friend who she wrote to, and she said, I congratulate you, my dear good friend, that God gives you the opportunity of being useful to souls, but walk with caution because present circumstances make this work difficult for you. You say it seems to you better to be schismatic rather than to be utterly without religion. But, my dear friend, you cannot have weighed the matter, for in conscience we must not leave our brethren in error. If they go to the instruction of an intruder, they are automatically out of the way of salvation. And then she says, they won't be punished for it, but it's better for them to remain without false instruction than to get the Mass.
Mm.
And then later on in another thing, she said, however severe God's guidance may seem to us at times, it's always the guidance of a Father who is infinitely good, wise, and kind. He leads us to our goal by different paths. And after all, my dear good friend, let's be honest. Isn't it true that we tend to spoil the work of grace in us? So it's to our advantage to experience the withdrawal of grace and abandonment by God. Then we must act as little children do in the dark, clasp the hand of father or mother, and go where we are led.
Hmm. Nice. That's great.
Yeah, it. I thought it was very timely for me to read that after seeing that movie. I was like, oh, yeah, we kind of tend to forget the basics because all these kind of thought experiment type things can be very muddling.
Hmm. Yeah, I agree with that.
And I'm not saying to run out and, you know, martyr yourself because, you know, the first Christians were living in the catacombs. But on the other hand, they weren't denying the faith when they were caught up with finally.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And, yeah, and luckily, you know, we're not being put to death over here in the Western world anyway. Not physical death anyway.
Yeah.
But it does still happen in the world, and that's important to know.
Well, yeah.
In Egypt.
And the quieter we are now here, the less our voice is heard. And I'm not saying go out and stand on a street corner unless that's your bag. If God's calling you to do that, enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
But just in daily life.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to speak up when you don't want to, because otherwise God's voice isn't heard at all.
Mm. Good point.
Yeah, and that's a bad silence.
Right. Not a good silence. Wow.
No.
All right. Was there anything else you'd like to say about this movie?
I would say when you look at the, if somebody's watching it, I've heard it improves upon watching again, but I just can't do it. But if you're watching it, if you notice shots from above looking down, those in the business are called God's eye views.
Hmm.
And Scorsese uses those to certain effect. They're not tons of them, but like when they're going across, they show them on the water being taken to Japan and they show them from above. And then it kind of, the view goes up to, you know, the sun in one of those great shots shining through the clouds. Like, wow, in case we didn't understand, that's the God's eye view. Here we are. Yeah. So, so when the three priests are walking and talking about Father Ferreira and there's this wonderful sideways shot of them going up these steps, that's the God's eye view. So God's, you know, God's involved. God's paying attention. It's just these people are on their own.
Yeah.
The movie.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is not a movie that I probably will watch again because I watched it and then I proposed that we talk about it and then I didn't watch it again.
Oh, really?
But I did watch the end again.
Oh, okay.
It was like I just watched the end. I was like, yeah, let me make sure I've got this. And the cock crowing was something I wanted to make sure it was really there.
Oh,
because
yeah.
It is subtle.
And it's in the book.
It is good. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, most of those basic things, when I started looking, I found Schmoop had online a chapter-by-chapter summary.
Uh-huh.
Because I was going, it had been so long since I read it, I couldn't remember, did he really have these conversations about, you know, the man with the four concubines and this kind of thing. And those were all in there.
Mm.
So it's interesting to see how a director puts a gloss on something.
Yeah.
Like that ending's not there, the thing with the cross.
Yeah, and that, yeah. So it makes me want to read the book, and maybe I will sometime, just to find out how it was ended. But yeah, so I mean, what did Scorsese say with that?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, he may have said less. You know, it's almost, that was one of the things he said in the interview was, you know, the interviewer asked him, what is the heart of the book? And he said the heart of the book was faith and stripping everything away and having nothing but faith. And then he started to talk about how the church and the church helps, but it's all very personal. Yeah, so it really was, you know, it made me think that he was saying that it's almost as if everything, no matter what you come up with, is okay. It's everybody's on their own personal journey kind of a situation, which is a New Agey thing that you were talking about that sort of seeped through.
Well, it's kind of Protestant.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Also, I mean, it's... You know, the church is important, but it's personal, and it is personal. Each person's faith, each person's relationship with God is personal.
Yeah.
But if you don't trust, if you're Catholic and you don't trust the church to give you the guidance that you need, you're no better than Father Rodriguez, now that I think about it, with everybody kind of babbling at him. You're pulled in 1,000 directions. What's your one thing? Because God's not sitting next to you whispering in your ear. That's just my opinion as a Catholic. Don't let anybody take that.
I'm thinking about what you said. Yeah. So it is definitely a personal journey for everybody. Mm-hmm. Everybody's on a different place on the road. So that I'm with, you know, and I do believe that.
Mm-hmm.
But I do believe that everybody can't come up with their own answers. You know, it's like, you know, the truth is the truth and the truth is there.
Yeah.
We don't all get to make up our own truth. So that right. I am not with, right?
Yeah, it's like if everybody who comes along has to rediscover the laws of gravity or thermodynamics for themselves, you build on what wise men already have discovered.
Right, right.
And it doesn't mean you don't examine it and question it if parts of it seem odd to you, but then you go based on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so... Yeah, I think as we proved, this is why I like the movie. Mm-hmm. Maybe someday I will watch it again, but it'll be a long time when I have 3 hours.
Well, and it may say something completely different to you at that
maybe
point.
Maybe it does.
Because and, you'll be at a and different part of your life.
Maybe that's what is good about ambiguity.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
I did have one more question now that I think about it, because... Yeah. I was taking a walk this morning thinking about this movie and just wishing I could slap somebody's face for it. And just in case anyone needed my opinion. And going, you know, we just read Flannery O'Connor. Now think how she treats things in her work. What would she have said about this movie?
Oh my gosh. What would Flannery O'Connor say about this movie?
People are crying over someone getting hurt, and she's going, I knew when I wrote Greenleaf is that at the end that bull was going to be goring that woman. I couldn't wait to get her on its horns.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
And when I think of it like that, the movie just looks softer and squishier than ever.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? You know, yeah, we talked about Flannery O'Connor last time, and it is a different thing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's a
there was a lot of very difficult things that happened in this movie. You know, some of that torture stuff, it was really mm-hmm. hard to watch, and but you're right, the result was squishy, and that's a good way to put it.
Yeah, my hero is the guy who I wish I could remember his name now, but the peasant who's the one who's left on those three crosses out in the middle of the sea with the tide coming in, and he is singing his little heart out. He's like, here's my faith. And when people are dying on each side of him, he is offering up prayers and thanking God for them, their entry into glory.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the priest should have been doing. The priest should have been learning from him.
Yeah.
Instead, he's, you know, crying in a cave watching.
Yeah. He was very upset.
Well, and I get it. I wouldn't, you know, I don't want to be too definite. But, you know, just as a work of fiction and what it's saying, no thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'd like to think I could be like that guy. I don't know if I could.
Right.
Hope I'm not tested that much ever.
And me too. I don't know if I'd pass, but.
Well, we don't until we're put to the test,
until
right?
Until we're there, yep.
So.
For sure. All right. Well, thanks for watching it.
Oh, no, it was absolutely worth watching and talking about.
Good. Excellent, excellent.
Yep.
All right. Good so, course. Next. Finally, we'll do something a little lighter. And this time I really mean it.
Oh, yeah. Nothing but good feelings here.
That's right. Okay, I mostly mean it. Ender's Game by Orson Scott Card.
Sorry.
Yeah, I'm picking heavy stuff, aren't I?
Yeah, well, you know, it's all good and worth talking about. Mm-hmm. Yep. But wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, good stuff. All right, but that's what we're going to talk about next time. Ender's Game, not the movie, but the book.
Yep.
Yep.
Going to the source.
Going to the source, right.
And it's quite good, it's an easy read, so if you haven't read it.
Yeah, it flies. It flies, that book. All right, great.
Okay.
All right, well, thanks, everybody.
Yes, we'll talk to you again soon.
All right, we'll see you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.